I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Former Philadelphia Eagles player Brian Dawkins spoke about his struggle with depression when he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame earlier this summer.
As you've been listening all, and you probably read all this week, I suffer from depression. I went through it mightily my rookie year. I suffered through suicidal thoughts. And I wasn't just suffering through suicidal thoughts. I was actually planning the way that I would kill myself so my wife would get the money.
Another football star, Steve Smith Sr., wrote on NFL.com about how he felt trapped, inferior, and alone despite all his achievements on the field. He was haunted by the question, "What's wrong with me?" He went on to say, "I've learned through hours and hours of counseling, and I'm still learning so much about the battle I fight within." I mention these two men sharing these painful and intimate feelings of depression and inadequacy because we're talking about the unique mental health needs and challenges of African Americans. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio are two psychiatrists, Delaine Cassiano and Kareem Salam, co-authors of a new book called Mind Matters, a resource guide to psychiatry for Black communities. Delaine Cassiano is an adult psychiatrist with an interest in cultural issues in psychiatry and women's behavioral health. She sees patients in her private practice and at a community mental health center here in Philadelphia. Delaine Cassiano, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Kareem Salam is an adult child and adolescent psychiatrist, also clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Drexel University College of Medicine, and he's medical director of the Friends Hospital's Adolescent Unit. Kareem Salam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you so much for having us.
You're very welcome. And let me round out our trio of guests with psychologist Howard Stevenson. He's the Constance Clayton Professor of Urban Education and Professor of Africana Studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative and Forward Promise. Howard Stevenson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Let me begin with our two football players talking about their depression, their feelings of inadequacy. And if I can put this to you, Delaine, how important is it for celebrities, for football players, for people of some public note to speak so personally about things that are so intimate?
Yes, yes. Those were such powerful words, such a powerful statement. Due to a legacy of mistreatment in this country, African Americans have a tendency to show strength to cope with issues of racism, discrimination, stereotypes. And so oftentimes any mental health symptoms such as depression are often concealed because it would be a sign of weakness, for example. And so it takes a lot of effort to then speak out, which hopefully would encourage others and take some of the pressure off of them, that it actually is okay to talk about times where you don't feel well. It doesn't make you any less weak or any less powerful.
Let me quote something else, and I'll put this to you, Kareem. This is going back to Smith on his piece in NFL.com. He said, "My advice to anyone suffering from mental health issues, specifically athletes who can relate, is this: ask for help. Stop trying to deal with these serious matters alone. You are not alone. Believe me." These are strong and powerful words.
Absolutely. From strong and powerful men. These are football players. And these Steve Smith and Doc, these were guys who were in the game, pillars of strength. And for them to disclose their struggles and to share their vulnerability, this is an invitation for folks to get treatment. If Doc and if Steve Smith could get help, then what's my excuse? You know?
Well, let me get you, Howard Stevenson, in on the conversation. Is there something unique to African Americans that prevents them from seeking mental health treatments?
Yes, you could look at issues historically, and as Dr. Cassiano has mentioned, that the idea that if you've gone through oppression because of just your presence and your difference, and public officials, people whose job it is to protect and serve, to take care of you, to teach you, are part of that sort of pressure to diagnose you incorrectly, to hurt you, it's very hard for you to be disclosive about your pain. And that's any kind of pain, particularly mental health pain, when you've been defined as not human. Historically, we could also look at the mental health system as part of, like, the justice system, a place to incarcerate and keep black folks from living their lives. So in many respects, there's a history of how this system hasn't been kind as a way to limit their mobility and freedom.
It's interesting, in the pre-interviews that you did, Delaine Cassiano and Kareem Salaam, you both mentioned Tuskegee. Of course, this was done decades ago, but nonetheless seems to help us explain some of the mistrust of mental or medical communities. And this is when it was a syphilis study and African-Americans were essentially part of the study but withheld treatment. That still really defines this relationship between a health community?
Yes, yes. And if we take a step back, as Dr. Stevenson had said, and really talking about the historical context, that there have been centuries of mistreatment of African Americans in this country, and with the civil rights movement being 50 years ago. And so when you think about the relative time that all of this passed, something like the study, we'll use that word for now,
yeah,
and Tuskegee,
quotes,
yes,
right.
That it's not a stretch that even today in 2018 that there might be some difficulty with a system that hasn't always been trustworthy. And it can happen in everyday circumstances when you go to your primary care doctor's office and it's not welcoming. Again, these are everyday occurrences that make it even more challenging.
Part of the reason for the book, Kareem Salaam, is the fact that you are of a minority when it comes to psychiatry, that there are, 4 or 5% of psychiatrists who are African-American.
Correct.
How significant is that, do you think, especially for a patient?
Imagine how liberating it might be if you come from a group that some folks have pejoratively referred to as an oppressed minority. And so folks are so liberated when I enter the room, and they had no idea that I was an African-American psychiatrist. I actually have a Muslim name, an Arabic name, so many folks assume I'm Middle Eastern. And so what we do in mental health is largely predicated on establishing rapport. And so relationships. So immediately folks let down their guard and they may say, I might give this guy the benefit of the doubt that he could access and identify my humanity. And he may have relatives who've had similar experiences to mine and my family. And so oftentimes folks are so encouraged when they realize that I'm African American.
Because they feel they can trust or that you will understand something that perhaps a well-meaning but white psychiatrist might not.
Absolutely. And I think that played into the book as well. Mm. 10 African-American psychiatrists. And, we assume that people might give us the benefit of the doubt in terms of delivering this information, and that we assume that folks would say, well, these guys are probably not trying to oppress us. Mm. They're probably not trying to bomb our brains with high doses of psychotropic medication. And so we are inviting folks to receive treatment.
Does that affect compliance, that, what you just said, the idea affecting compliance?
Absolutely. There was a recent study out of Oakland that showed that black men followed the advice of African-American male physicians compared to their Caucasian and Asian counterparts. So in terms of following screening recommendations for diabetes, for cholesterol, there's a 20% difference in compliance with screening recommendations when the purveyor of that information is an African-American male physician.
I'm holding that study in my hand as you speak. And if I can get it over to you, Howard Stevenson, this applied to medical doctors, but do you think this also applies then to psychologists and psychiatrists?
Absolutely. Even if you look at the field, and some of the work that we're doing at Penn around racial literacy is trying to look at evidence-based interventions or treatments. And if you look at what's out there now, how do you make these treatments culturally relevant for groups that are oppressed, that are different, where the measures are not addressing that issue of oppression, the measures are not really addressing the kinds of challenges? So in some research, we know that evidence-based treatments that actually use culturally relevant measurement and interventions have a higher rate of success. And part of that has to do with what Dr. Salam has mentioned around, I feel like you're thinking about all of my life, not just, you know, me as a patient.
Let me go back to you because, Dr. Cassiano, you deal a lot with women. And I wonder whether that mask, if that's too strong a word, but this notion of a strong black woman, that's something I think in many ways people respect and honor and feel as if she has it all because she's a strong black woman. What's happening underneath?
Yes, it's so interesting to hear Dr. Salam mention how patients may sort of perceive him. I always say the number one question I get asked by patients is, Cassiano, is that Italian? And I think it's because right. part that, what's underlying that is, like, will you get me? Who are you? Will you understand my experience? And so when you see an African-American female, they may be surprised.
Right.
So I simply answer, my father's from Puerto Rico, you know, my mother is African American. And so, again, when you come back to the issue of women and a strong black woman, this can be a sign of strength. This can be something that's a coping skill. The challenge is that it doesn't leave a lot of room if somebody doesn't feel well. And so it can be hard to say to others, I need help. I don't feel strong right now. How do I get help? And then if you match that with the encounter with a provider or a healthcare system that doesn't take the time or doesn't have the understanding of that, a lot of times symptoms simply go unnoticed, undiagnosed, undertreated. And so, again, it's very layered, that intersection of race and gender.
Well, and I think I don't think it's easy for anyone to talk about their deep feelings of anxiety or an inferiority or insecurity. But I hear what you're saying is that there's this sort of this overlay for black women.
Mm-hmm. And it's the stigma, if we're going to use that word, is different for African Americans. It is tied, unfortunately, to these stereotypes that are sometimes portrayed, that African Americans are incompetent or lazy, not hardworking, and it's tied to all of these notions that when you go into the clinical encounter, you're really combating all of that in just a few minutes.
Right.
And it, as a woman, again, sometimes the issues of gender are not even explored.
Because this is such a large issue. We're almost up on a break here. Dr. Salam, anything you want to add to that?
Quick anecdote. And oftentimes in the hospital, in the adolescent unit, and even in other places in the hospital, I'm typically asked, are you the social worker?
You know, not the psychiatrist?
Not the psychiatrist, or anything but the psychiatrist. My typical rejoinder is, or someone might refer to me as Mr. Salam in lieu of Dr. Salam. And I say, well, I was Mr. Salam prior to being Dr. Salam. Just don't call me Mrs. Salam. She's a lot better looking.
It's always good to have a good quip, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we are going to take a very short break and get back to Dr. Kareem Salam and Dr. Delaine Cassiano and Dr. Howard Stevenson. And we are talking about mental health issues in the African-American community. And we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation and much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with psychiatrist Delaine Cassiano and Kareem Salam, co-authors of a new book called Mind Matters, a resource guide to psychiatry for black communities. And Dr. Cassiano is an adult psychiatrist with an interest in cultural issues in psychiatry, also women's behavioral health. She has a private practice here in the Philadelphia area, also works at a community mental health center in Philadelphia. Dr. Salam is an adult, child, and adolescent psychiatrist, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Drexel University College of Medicine, and medical director of the Friends Hospitals Adolescent Unit, which is also in Philadelphia. And Howard Stevenson is a psychologist, professor of urban education, and professor of Africana studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative and Forward Promise. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join join our conversation. Dr. Stevenson, let me go to you. And you know, words matter so much, and I'm thinking we use the words mental illness. And I think for a lot of people, I don't think race matters here, they just say, I don't want that. I don't want to be called mentally ill, which is associated with feeling crazy or being seen as crazy. Can we rebrand this? Can we call it something else? And does it matter?
I think it does matter in terms of how you want to communicate to groups that are often stigmatized, which is what I love about the book that Dr. Casciano and Dr. Salam and others have done, because they try to demystify illness with other kinds of terms. Right. And so well-being and health, or taking care of yourself, or in black communities, how you even can connect to other modes like spirituality, religion, to get to this kind, these challenges is another way to go around this notion of illness.
You see it that way, Dr.
Well, yes,
Cassiano?
And I was thinking about your questions about women. So women are at risk for depression in a way that's different from men, for example. So there's thought to be this relationship between serotonin and estrogen, and so that at any different point in a woman's life, whether it's every month or different times during pregnancy, the postpartum period, menopause, there can be a shift in the levels of serotonin, which are thought to be associated with depression. I say all that to say that African-American women are actually more likely to seek help from informal services or non-medical sources. So they may talk to trusted friends, family, but they're more likely to go to a primary care doctor or an OBGYN. And so if we talk about wellness in an OBGYN setting, it could open the door.
Right.
And if providers don't have this understanding and this awareness, then they can really miss an opportunity.
I wonder, too, about the role of the church, Dr. Salam.
Oh, spirituality is pivotal. A belief in the unseen. Think about the experience of African Americans. There's the middle passage from Africa to the Americas, having to survive slavery, Jim Crow, and racism in its various iterations. You have to have hope, a belief in the unseen, a belief in things becoming better than they are now, and things shifting in the direction of how they ought to be in lieu of how they are currently. And so that gives you something to work towards. And for many people, myself included, that is central to their lives. And so if you discount that, you could discount them. And sometimes folks' spirituality is part of their core identity, so much a part of them like their name. So
it needs to be acknowledged.
It must be acknowledged.
And understood and worked with, I guess.
Yes, and used as a tool to assist them in accessing treatment and remaining engaged with treatment.
Dr. Stevenson, I'm thinking about some of the implicit and explicit bias or even racism. And I know for black men, oftentimes trying to hail a cab is hard.
Yeah.
Or for black adolescent males, people might cross the street when they see them coming. Help us understand how that affects someone's psychology, their mental health, their well-being.
Yeah. Well, part of the challenge, and again, the benefit of this book is how you help people see that folks are threatened by black people in ways that are subtle and very direct. So the idea that we could have authority figures like teachers and police overreact to moments that are sometimes, when you look back, seen as quite regular. This issue of bias is better understood in a sort of threat moment. And so we're not always aware of our threats, but our reactions. So we have, there's data that look at preschool expulsions of black boys, for example. This is four times that of any other group. And part of that has to do not with their behavior, but the adults' overreaction. Some of the work out of Yale, Dr. Walter Gilliam's work, points this out. And that this is an adult problem, not a child problem, but it's related in this notion of, if I'm threatened by you, do I have the right to protect myself in these moments? And so that can show up anywhere. Even with the angry black man or angry black woman, there's a notion in which you're somehow having to shape yourself based on someone else's fear of you, when there's nothing wrong or unhealthy about being angry or about being black or about being female or male.
Well, Dr. Salam, you write about this in the book, about the miss, especially for black males in schools being misdiagnosed, the defiant behavior as opposed to, learning disabilities or learning differences.
Sure, absolutely. But just to put a slightly different spin on this notion of how African-American males might be treated differently. You might run into one thing I've encountered are young African-American males in a clinical setting who have violent surgical scars on their bodies, which usually suggests a gunshot wound. And so these are young guys who they've experienced this horrific trauma, and folks look at them and say, he looks like some guy in a hip-hop video or something. He must be a tough guy. You know, he's not vulnerable. But this was a human being. This was a human being who wasn't born with that scar. They arrived at that scar. And they arrived at that scar through a pathway of trauma. So if you access that human being's humanity and realize that we were all born very similarly, okay, why don't we address that, find out how he arrived at that, find out why he's self-medicating that with whatever substance, okay, and encourage him to seek treatment.
But you're talking about living with a certain level of threat and violence.
Absolutely.
And certainly in a city like Philadelphia, it's here.
And one might imagine, Dr. Stevenson and I, we belong to the demographic group African-American males that has the lowest life expectancy in this country. Mm-hmm. And so this living under constant threat, it can weather you. It could age you prematurely. You could be 40 years old, but physiologically, you're 65. So you have young, right.
No, that's okay. I was just thinking of the word toxic stress. I mean,
absolutely.
That's something that we are all learning about. We did a show not so long ago with principals, school principals in Philadelphia, and one principal is using with her elementary school children the kind of therapy that comes with dealing with toxic stress. And this is it's a school, it's in North Philly, and they're doing it. I mean, it's such a... It tells us so much, it seems, Dr. Cassiano.
Well, what comes to mind is that I've been in Philadelphia for 15 years now, and I've been at different areas of the city and different community mental health centers. And there has been a shift of the system that is slow. It's a slower response to all of the trauma. So community mental health centers were really created for those with chronic and persistent mental illness. You know, for example, with patients with chronic psychosis, schizophrenia. The system was not built to help to manage the volume of trauma that comes in. So at all of the different sites that I've gone to, one of the primary areas of concern is trauma. And if a system is not adaptable to be able to address that, it's not going to meet the needs.
And lifelong untreated trauma, Dr. Stevenson, is is a lifelong life of difficulty.
Yes, yes. And not recognizing it, you can imagine, even if you're going to experience threat, what happens to you over time. There's also the issue, though, of historical intergenerational trauma. So one thought about intervention is thinking about how has this disadvantage or toxic stress been happening for century, for example. So can you trace back how these same processes of systems, how our reactions to those systems have led to health outcomes that are not not positive at all.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Howard Stevenson from the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, a psychiatrist, Delaine Cassiano, and psychiatrist Kareem Salam, and they are co-authors of a new book called Mind Matters, and it's subtitled A Resource Guide to Psychiatry for Black Communities, and it's filled with chapters dealing very specifically about some of the issues that we have been talking about. And we want you to join our conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Josh from, it looks like, Reading, Pennsylvania to join our conversation. And Josh, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
I had a question for the doctors, specifically in the drug treatment area of psychiatry. And I preface the question, I've been in drug treatment for 9 years, and to see the lack of diversity in psychiatrists for the African-American drug treatment, is that a downfall in drug treatment that needs to be diversified more to help that group of persons? And is that then affecting their recovery by not being able to access that diversified field of psychiatrists?
Yeah, fair enough, Josh. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Dr. Salam, I'm going to toss that to you.
Josh, that's an excellent question, but I would hazard a guess and say that in all subspecialties of psychiatry, there's a dearth of African-American professionals. But I actually think you hit the nail on the head, and it goes back to rapport, relationships. Will this provider understand me? Will this provider connect with me? One of the co-authors of the book, Dr. Tim Benson, is an expert in addictions and is actually the assistant medical director of the NBA drug program. Hmm. So these providers are out there, and Tim happens to be based in L.A., but there are providers, but you have to seek them. But I think, Josh, you identified a need for these professionals.
Does it say, though, Dr. Cassiano, that that white psychiatrists are not the appropriate person to deal with an African-American patient? Or is there something that psychiatrist needs to understand that would make them a better therapist?
That's quite a big question.
It is a question.
Yes.
But you know, if there's a dearth of providers and there's a great need, then...
Yes, we have to address it.
We have to figure out how do you hook people up?
Yeah, so I was the cultural psychiatry course director at the University of Pennsylvania for several years, and so this is a question that was posed many, many times and time again. And the way that I look at it is that what's important for all of us as providers is to really, one, be open. Be open to the fact that depression, for example, or other mental health problems may be expressed differently or look differently in different populations, but also for us to be open to examine our own biases and what we bring to the encounter. And then lastly, is to work collaboratively with the patients, but also with other providers and with each other. So seek out mentors, consultants, and learn more about these differences in both diagnosis and treatment so that we can work together and really address what the problems are.
And you want to add something, Dr. Salam? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Folks who are interested in finding a provider of color and they encounter the problem of the dearth of these providers, I would really encourage them to seek treatment, and it's more important to have an empathic provider than no provider, because we would like to diminish this suffering immediately, sooner versus later.
What's the treatment, Dr. Stevenson, for racism?
I think if you take it from the standpoint of a structural, social, societal issue, we got a long way to go, and the examples in our country now about retrenchment is a lesson. But I would add to what's being said regarding training, the kind of training. We all get training for stuff we don't know as professionals. And unfortunately, the reason we use the word racial literacy is a way to say that there's a particular set of skills that are necessary to do empathic supportive care from mental health providers, educators, justice folks. But you have to have a lot of training and practice in it. You can't just come to it. There's some people who are empathic, but they're still clueless about what are the politics of oppression like for a client in front of me. And so in the same way that we need much more training that is skillful, and people have to have much more practice, good hearts are important, but it's not the way we think about other forms of care. And so to what degree are we qualified, practiced, trained to deliver these sort of racially literate approaches?
As you all three were talking, I was thinking about this notion of compliance. I mean, I think doctors and patients struggle with this. Mm-hmm. But in context of our conversation, Dr. Cassiano, how do you see compliance or even non-compliance, which is obviously a problem?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it goes back to many of the notions or concepts that we've been talking about. Within the field of psychiatry, African-Americans, again, are less likely to seek formal mental health treatments. And that the reasons for that are very layered. But part of that could be worry that psychiatric treatments are not going to be helpful. So this medication is not going to be helpful to me. It could potentially cause side effects. It can potentially cause addiction or take away my control, you know, that I'm going to be too sluggish. And so the idea is that that patients aren't adhering to our recommendations doesn't fully examine the beliefs that are behind them. And so I routinely ask patients, what are your thoughts about medications? You're seeing a psychiatrist. Right. Why did you think they referred you to a psychiatrist? What are your hopes? And explore them more and try to take the pressure off of them. But also it's important for providers to know that these beliefs are there and that some groups, for example, may metabolize medications differently. It's also on us as providers to try to address that adherence.
Well, I wanted to take us back to Tuskegee and the kind of suspicion. Dr. Slum, go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. Let's talk about the importance of language, compliance. Imagine how people who've been enslaved or oppressed, when they hear that term compliance, you will comply, you will obey. So I tend to use the term adherence, okay? So we want you to stick to the treatment plan that we've worked collaboratively to develop, okay? For example, medication management, that is a huge concern in the African-American community. Are you trying to drug me up? Are you trying to drug up my child? And so things need to be simplified, and they have to be rational. They have to make sense. So the provider, the prescriber, should be able to explain in accessible language the target symptoms that are identified for this particular medication. And in terms of side effects, every medication has a litany of side effects. You want to talk about the most common and the ones that could be the most debilitating, and have a very frank and honest discussion and remind folks that I cannot impose this medication on you. I need your permission. It's part of the informed consent process. So it really shifts power and control to the consumer of healthcare instead of the provider of healthcare.
Dr. Stevenson, where it belongs?
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, the healthy, more competent providers engage this mistrust. They're open to listening about it instead of trying to pretend it's not there. It's like an elephant in every medical room, any therapy room, that I may not trust you. And so given what we know now, engaging that, and providers who know how to appreciate that we need that resistance. If you think about a benefit of some form of healthy sort of coping is your resistance to unfairness and injustice that you might perceive. Mm-hmm. And so a therapist, a psychiatrist that embraces that is on the right track.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dr. Howard Stevenson, also with us, Dr. Kareem Salam and Dr. Delaine Cassiano. We are talking about mental health issues, wellness in the African-American community. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with psychiatrist Delaine Cassiano, Kareem Salam, co-authors of a new book called Mind Matters, a resource guide to psychiatry for Black communities. Also with us, Howard Stevenson. He's a psychologist affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Cheryl from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Cheryl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for the psychologist. Dr. Salam, if you could answer this question. I want to know if you can offer suggestions on how healthcare providers who are working in the hospital, when they come upon these disparities of care. For instance, I'm a healthcare provider, and sometimes I see that patients, it's right before me in live time, that a physician might treat a person who's Caucasian or white with similar circumstances. Obviously, nobody has the exact same circumstances or situation. And I'll see at the same time African-Americans who are treated with disparity, with less tolerance, and as having ultimatums. And it can range from, you know, behavioral outbursts if they're acting out, or it could be even an option on whether they should have, like, their gallbladder removed. So the Caucasian, the doc will come in, tell them all their options. You know, you can actually change your way of eating. You know, we don't have anything blocked right now, so you don't have to have this surgery. And then you get an African-American come in the room as a patient, and the docs will come in with the paperwork to sign the consent to do the surgery without giving the patient. And this is... it happens often. It's not just a one-time situation. I've been in nursing since 1979.
Oh, wow.
So there's a pattern.
Sure. Cheryl, I really...
And at, Yes.
I know. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm sure all three of our guests want to respond. Dr. Salaam, can I start with you? She directed the question to you. She's a provider, and she sees this.
Yes. Really quickly, whenever you have a relationship and there's a significant power differential in that relationship requires oversight. So whether it's a physician, patient, whether it's police and citizen. And so in the absence of that oversight and regulation, that could lead to disaster. So it is very helpful when patients have advocates. Mm. It is very helpful that these kinds of things are identified. Most hospitals have patient advocates. Everyone in a hospitals are organized by layers, and everyone has a supervisor. So in order to fix this problem, it must be identified. Okay, so you really have to pursue these channels, identify the problem, pursue the proper channels in order to correct behavior.
Do you want to add to that, Dr. Cassiano? And I mean, I saw all of you sort of nodding in recognition of what she was talking about, which is a pretty stark difference about how Black patients in hospitals are treated and white patients are treated.
Yes, I agree with everything Dr. Salaam said. There's this issue of informed consent and not coercing or having patients feel forced into treatments. Guiding principles are always to treat everyone with respect and to explain all of their options, so put everything in a context. And again, to work collaboratively. So if one is providers in one discipline and sees a provider of another discipline, talking with supervisors, the oversight. That's why there's supposed to be these checks and balances to try to prevent disaster.
Are you surprised, Dr. Stevenson?
Oh, no. Having run residential treatment centers as well as for young people who've been abused and in different health systems, I've seen exactly what she's describing. And it's painful to hear, even as the caller speaks about it. And unfortunately, this would be an example of poor care that sometimes only gets addressed when somebody speaks up. So the ability to actually challenge when you are in a lower power status in these systems is a big issue. One argument for literacy and racial literacy is practicing how do you speak up to a supervisor or to someone in another profession about an injustice that you see instead of just doing it cold. One argument for advocacy or finding advocates is can staff be trained on how to speak up to those who are higher up on the for the sake of justice, which is a system-wide ethical issue, that you want people to speak up when they see it as a better healthcare sort of safety environment. But it's painful to hear, and unfortunately, without somebody speaking up and taking the risk, this injustice continues.
Cheryl, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, but since you raised it, is there a way to discuss this, especially with a superior or a higher up within the hierarchy of a hospital?
Well, part of the idea in some way in what we've done with barbers and young people who've been thought of because they're Black or otherwise, how do you deal with police officers who might harass you or think that you're doing something when you're not? And how do you be both respectful and humane in the same process? So, and what was mentioned earlier by Dr. Salaam about a sort of what we call healthy comeback lines that are able to represent your dignity.
Always good to have in your back pocket. Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
And there are racial healthy comeback lines, too, that you can practice that don't incur the anger of the other person, respect them, but also challenge at the same time. And family therapy used to call this kick and stroke. So there's a way in which you stroke for the sake of kicking, and kicking could be a little kick to say there's something wrong here, and I appreciate your ability to get to this, but it's a balance. It's a balance. And some of us, because we're so angry about this and we see it, we want to lash. And in systems with power, there are different ways you must work. And so that's the training.
I wonder, too, having read your book and having this conversation with you, is there a way to do a better job in mental health education instead of understanding, recognizing symptoms? As you were talking about, Dr. Cassiano, about, you know, the strong Black woman, I mean, that's a survival mechanism in a lot of ways, but it does then push down those vulnerable, probably scary feelings.
Yes, yes. So that's part of the reason that we wanted to write a book like this that speaks both to the community, but it's also applicable to providers and to different disciplines. It's a conversation that needs to be had, and a lot of it is practicing these sorts of things, but also reaching out to mentors for guidance, consultants, getting that support when you see something that you don't feel is safe,
right.
And then asking for that help.
You want to add to that,
sure.
Dr. Salam?
Sure. And again, you never want to sound cliche, but you want to treat people the way you would want your relative treated, that you would mm-hmm. want to be treated yourself. I think they refer to it as the golden rule. And again, you know, we are dealing with human beings, okay, and we have to have a healthy respect for others' humanity. It's critically important. We also felt initially that the book was not written for providers, and that was not the initial intent, but it could be quite useful,
mm-hmm.
especially providers who deal with large segments of the African-American population.
But I'm thinking, I think the whole country could use some mental health guidance and education, but whether schools and counseling session. There are so many ways that we can all, I think all of us, learn to understand and recognize the things that we don't have names for, but
sure.
we might be feeling.
For example, you should be curious and you should ask questions like, how come this gentleman is so frustrated? How come they're so angry? And how can I help them? Also, how could I do that in the service of a better outcome? So increased engagement in treatment, a lowered blood pressure, increased adherence with a medication regimen, increased adherence with therapy appointments. Mm-hmm. So you have to have targets in mind, okay? And you shouldn't just superficially judge people and write them off.
Do we send them? Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Cassiano.
And these conversations that only happen in the medical field. So with this book, what I have really enjoyed is all of the people that I've been talking to. It happens in schools. It happens in religious institutions. It happens in barbershops and in beauty salons and in the supermarket, in the park. These are conversations. So mental health is everywhere.
Well, you mentioned barbers, Dr. Stevenson.
Sure, yeah, and barbers can have communicated a lot. We've done a study regarding how powerful barbers can be to even help around reducing sexual risk as well as violence risk. One of the things that also comes up is to what degree in some of these issues around anger, where it triggers threat from others when black folks are engaged in anger, that for our teenagers, many of them are underlying that anger is an anxiety that doesn't come out. And so sometimes we can have our clients, project bravado or anger as a way to deal with something that's much deeper. That could be depression. It could be anxiety. And without, getting to the source of that, it looks on the outside like toughness. But inside, it's a lot more well within the mental health, well-being, illness frame.
How do you get to that, though?
Well,
you get to the,
you can't be afraid
that.
Of young people. You can't be afraid of black folks. You have to address your own issues. And this is true for school teachers, for police officers. We even acknowledge that some of these professionals want to do a good job, but if they haven't managed their own threats and fears,
mm-hmm.
their first reaction is to attack first and heal later or teach later. We need to reverse that.
You work with young people.
Oh, absolutely.
Dr. Salam.
One advantage I have in working with young people is it gives me a good excuse to remain engaged with what they're into in terms of pop culture. And so it's not about emulating them, but it's about taking an interest in what they find interesting. And again, that helps you establish rapport. And again, they could let their guard down. Now, this concept applies with adults as well. I remember an encounter I had with someone who, in the course of the interview, made it clear to me, you want me to remember these three objects, Doc? I'm not going to remember them. I used to box, head trauma.
Oh.
And so I shifted into fights. and the person's affect, the outward expression of their emotional state lit up, and it helped with rapport. And so, again, it was a very human moment, and so now this person might be available to the treatment recommendations we've explored together.
Well, I'm thinking, too, you mentioned the church, and I wonder, I'll put this to you, Dr. Cassiano, whether church pastors, do they have the skills? Do they have the requisite skills to deal with people who are in crisis over depression or anxiety or PTSD or toxic stress?
Well, I think we can all be part of the same team. So I routinely go into churches and give presentations, but I work collaboratively with the pastors, the deacons, to, one, come up with a topic that will be of interest. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is another setting where I might not know what the interests are of that particular congregation. And so we work together to put together the entire program. And I think there is this interest and this desire to be a part of it, but each of us brings our own skill set. We're all trained in different ways.
Yeah.
And so if we can sort of learn from each other and bring that together, then I think we can reach even more people.
You're nodding your head.
And to piggyback off what Dr. Cassiano stated, we're trained differently, but we also have to know the limits of our training. So if you're a physician or if you're a clergy, you have to realize when you're out of your lane and you have to seek help. And the most intelligent people that I've encountered know the limits of their knowledge, and they know when to seek counsel. So we would definitely encourage that.
Here's a tweet from Edward. He said, mental health issues for underserved communities are top priority for telemedicine. Do your guests think that that could help expand health care in Black communities? Ever thought of that before? Dr. Stevenson?
I think it can. I think the challenge is who's going to follow up, right? Who's going to be still building that relationship that lasts and that you can eventually trust? So I'd still like to understand it and see what the studies are about it before I would give a full link. But I think in some communities we have gone to in rural places, I grew up in a rural place where your access to mental health care is non-existent. So the idea that you could get to folks in ways, I think it's still very possible. I mean, we've seen amazing stuff that barbers can do in 30 minutes, right?
Barbers can do in 30 minutes.
In 30 minutes in engaging young people about how to shift their thinking. But so I'm not going to throw out telecommuting as a, or
telemedicine.
I forgot myself
as off
well.
The charts until we see it.
Well, what I hear from the three of you is there are resources in the community, and it's a matter of trying to figure out, I guess, what works.
Yes, and technology is evolving, and I think that there's telemedicine. But I remember I was working with a primary care group that was trying to develop an app to be able to track your depression symptoms. And so I think it's all about how do we reach people. And if technology, advances in technology help us to do that, then again, the system is a little slower to be able to adapt to all of this. But it's really about how can we reach more people.
And we're almost out of time here, but to you, Dr. Salaam, yes. I played the two NFL football players talking about their own depression. It seems like something is in the air. I don't know whether I'm hallucinating or not. Do you feel like we're at an important juncture?
Yes, we are, Marty. And no, you're not hallucinating.
And I have three doctors to reinforce that.
Right. In terms of this message, now is the time. You could say this message should have been delivered a generation ago. It's unclear to me that it would have been as well received, but people are available. And life is about meeting people where they are, and people are prepared to have these conversations. We're all human beings. None of us are perfect. We all have issues. We all have problems. And if you deny that, then your issue is not being truthful.
On that note, we are ending our conversation. Dr. Kareem Salaam, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Delaine Cassiano, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And they are co-authors of a new book, Mind Matters, a resource guide to psychiatry for Black communities. And Dr. Howard Stevenson, thank you once again for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And he's a professor of urban education and professor of Africana studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative, and Forward Promise. Diana Martinez and Mike Villers are engineers for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. My thanks to Mary Cummings Jordan for filling in last week so I could go on vacation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.